History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we want to hear. We do not want them to go untold, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Auburn, California, with a Navy veteran of World War II who's got a pretty unique story. Frank Ormerod, 93 years old. Not originally from California, and I think when people hear you speak, they're going to realize that you're from another part of the country. Tell me where you grew up, Frank.
Fall River, Massachusetts.
What was that like in the 20s and 30s, growing up with a brother and a couple sisters?
Well, it was kind of rough. Yeah. A lot of people was on welfare, but my father had a job. He soaked cloth and caustic in that, keep it from shrinking. Anyways, he had what they call a steady job. But he only earned 20 bucks a week. But anyways, he took care of us, and we all got along good. We didn't go starving. My mother was a very, very good cook, and she could make food that tasted good. My father, he was a carpenter. He built the house that we lived in Westport. He was an all-handyman, you know. And I worked with my father. My brother didn't want to work with my father, but I worked with my father all the time. Whatever he did, I was. And in a way, that's how I learned to be a mechanic, through my father. And when I got older, I worked in the garage. Larry Souza owned the garage, but this other guy was a mechanic with him, and I was good friends with him, and we would work together. I worked for nothing. When I was 14 years old, I'd go and work and work and work. I thought about being a mechanic, so I went to a Cadillac and Oldsmobile dealer, and the war was on, and they had a lot of new cars stored. Anyways, I worked on all kinds of cars. Well, I went to him, and I told him I need a job. Did he need any mechanics? And, of course, I'm 16 years old. He says, yeah, you know where we can get them? I said, yeah. I'm a mechanic. He says, what do you mean you're a mechanic? You're only 16 years old. I says, well, I worked for other garages and learned on other cars. He says, well, come back tomorrow and I'll try you out. So I was a kid. I had a 36 Chevrolet. I got money for gas. So I didn't go back for 2 weeks. I went back to him, and I says, is that offer still good? He says, yeah, yeah. He says, I got this Oldsmobile, six-cylinder. I want you to put a clutch in it. I said, okay. So anyways, he told me what to get and put in it, and they gave me the work order. And I went, and I got the stuff, and I tore the engine and the clutch out and put the new stuff in, new clutch, adjusted it, put it on the floor. And he's walking around in the shop, and he comes back, and he sees the cars on the floor. He says, thought you told me you was a mechanic. I says, yeah, I am. He says, when you gonna get started? I says, I'm all done. He says, you can't be all done. He says, so I gave him the work order. He looked on it. He seen all the stuff was there. He said, okay, you got a job. So anyways, I went to work for Cadillac and Oldsmobile, and I worked for him about 8 months. One day he came to me and he says, I know you worked on this car. Did you take a B book? I says, no, I didn't take no B book. And he says, well, you didn't take the B book? I says, no, I didn't. I says, I got gas books. I got an R book for tractors at home. I lived in the country. You don't believe me? I asked him, you don't believe me? He says, no, I don't believe you. I says, well, Bob, I don't want to work for you anymore. I went down to the Pontiac people, and they didn't even have a mechanic. I worked for them, and I told them, I want to go in the Navy, so I'm going to quit. He said, oh, don't quit. we'll get you a deferment. I said, no, no, I don't want no deferment. I want to go in the Navy while I make my choice, not while the state government makes my choice and puts me on the Army. I don't want to be a ground pounder.
So you wanted to enlist in the Navy before they drafted you into the Army?
Yeah. So I enlisted in the Navy when I was 17. My mother signed for me to go in. I went to Sampson, New York. When I graduated from that, they put me on a shipment, went to New York City, Pier 92. And was that a hole? The captain's wife was more in command than he was. After the war was over, they prosecuted that captain for that. New Year's Eve, I went aboard the U.S. Argonaut, DD-617. I was on the ship. Of course, they're all lights out on the ship, you know, docking ship. Me being a new guy, I don't know my way around. And they called for me to go to number one gun. But I didn't know they wanted me to go to the upper handling room. But they wanted me to go to the lower handling room. I said, wow. He put me down there with two guys. One guy had ammunition shells, and they had a little hole. They passed the projectiles through the hole and put it in the elevator and run it up the upper handle room of this deck, gun number one. Anyways, I knew why they call them tin cans. You could hear the water going by the ship. It sounded like it was in a tin can. But anyways, I was on that, and they told us if a shell, the projectile, if it's damaged in any way, get rid of it right away, because you never know it's going to blow up. So I think we was over in Hitley, bombarding 88 guns. We went over there with three cruisers. There was the Dido, that's a British cruiser, the Brooklyn, and the Philadelphia. And I'll tell you a story about that one. They said cease fire. When you got to cease fire, you got to unload the gun and put the shell in the elevator or hold it. So this guy had a shell in the breech, holding one shell in his hand, and when they said clear the breech, he took the one he had in his hand and he threw it in the elevator, which it was the open elevator, and it was way down on the bottom of the deck down there, and that shell fell right by my feet. And I grabbed that shell because they told us to get rid of it right away. I was in, went through the chief's quarters, opened the hatch, went through the chief's quarters. There's a ladder, but it had a big hatch. They didn't open that on the way. They had a little hatch that you went through. So holding the shell, opened that hatch, got out, and threw the shell overboard. And when I threw that shell overboard, I started shaking like mad. Because I could have blown up and didn't know it, you know? I was scared. But anyways, I love the Navy. I love my country.
Well, and I want to ask you, too, because everybody seems to remember something. You said that when you're working at the dealership, the war was already on. But what about that day when everybody found out the war was on? Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Well, I was a young kid then, you know. But I remember it. Yes, I'm bombing the Pearl Harbor.
So on the Ordronox, what was that like being a teenager with all these other guys on this destroyer? And I'm sure you didn't really know what you guys were in for, right?
No, I didn't. But they were my age, too. You know, a lot of them were my age. But there was older ones. But we had a good captain. He was a good captain, but he was an awful drunk.
Well, and you mentioned that you guys bombarded Italy.
We was bombarding between Anzio and Naples. See, the Fifth Army had moved up and taken Anzio, and they had to have support for it because the Germans were going to push them out. The Germans was not too far away. They was in Rome, and they were pushing up. And that 88 gun they had was a mean sucker. It was really bombing them. So we went up. We would go up there with our destroyer and another destroyer, and we would go with a cruiser. And the first cruiser we went up with was a British cruiser, the Dido. They go into this bay, they drop the hook, and when they drop the hook, they put the ball up. That's to tell other ships that the anchor's down. Anyways, Your captain called over to our captain and said, would you like a target? We'll have a observer plane pick a target out. And they didn't use little Piper Cubs like we did. They used Spitfires. The captain got the message for a target, and I was a lookout up near the director. You know where the gun director is at the top? Well, anyways, we fired a shell to get range and bearing of the target, and the Germans fired back at us. And boy, I'm telling you, that's how to get your location. Try to one shell. And then they say, commence firing. You go. That comes in. So anyways, kept seeing that. Boom. We got on the way right away. And we went up there a couple times. The Philadelphia went up there, hitting targets out. And it was night, and the Germans had E-boats. And they said, oh, there's an E-boat out there. The captain says, oh, well, we'll just ram it. But it was his own escort. It was the U.S. ZD-613 lob. And she cut it right in the engine room. Killed quite a few guys in the engine room. But it didn't cut the ship in half because the shafts are so big. But anyways, we took the Philadelphia down to Malta because they had a Navy Yard down there. And that's where Franklin Roosevelt came in on a cruiser. And he had a big raised deck, you know, and had a hill on it for the wheelchair to go on. I seen that over there. We didn't see the president, but that was one time we were there. But we went all over the Mediterranean.
Well, and even, I guess it would be before you did all that, you had already come up close and personal with some Germans a lot closer to where you grew up, just off the East Coast.
Yes. Well, we sunk a German submarine. Well, I was down in the engine room, so I came up there, and when I seen those Germans floating in that water, my heart went out to them. I felt sorry for them. But we had guys on there, they were wicked. They said, shoot the sons of guns, kill them. But anyways, we picked up the captain and 17 of his men on our ship.
Yeah, and I want to get that whole story. So this is 75 years ago now. This was April of 1944. And I think today, I mean, most of us alive today weren't even alive in World War II. And what we know of World War II, we hear about the Pacific. We hear about D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. Maybe we hear a little bit about North Africa. We certainly hear about Pearl Harbor. But I think a lot of people today don't realize how many American ships were sunk in the Atlantic and how severe that German submarine threat was. So tell me where you guys were and how you discovered there was a German submarine there.
Well, we go on convoy duty over to Europe and we come back and then we'd be assigned to go to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Our Boston home port was Boston, but we never went there. We always went to the Brooklyn Navy Yard because it was a good Liberty town. And you know, guys get off a ship and that, they want to go someplace that's good, you know. So New York was a great town, and we had a lot of fun there. But anyways, we would go up to Casco Bay. There we go up for gunnery practice and all kinds of military things, and they come in order, submarine out there. Our squadron went out there. It's four destroyers, the 600, the Champlain, then there was the 601, the Neal, and then there was the 616, and then there was our ship, the Audronaux, DD-617.
And we'll hear about what exactly those destroyers encountered when we come back. 93-year-old Frank Ormerod of Auburn, California is our guest today. You can pull up some photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, what happened with that German sub? Its 28 survivors included the captain, whose path would cross again with some of the Audronaux sailors decades later. It's quite a story, and you'll hear it from Frank Ormerod when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and I'm sure as we get closer to July 4th, you're already making plans for how your family is going to celebrate that special anniversary of our nation's daring Declaration of Independence. Here on Hometown Heroes, our goal is to continually remind you of the men and women who have maintained that independence, the veterans who have risked their own lives enduring situations many of us can only imagine to ensure that our freedoms as Americans are preserved. Our guest today is Frank Ormerod, 93 years old, of Auburn, California, originally from Fall River, Massachusetts, and one of two brothers who served our country in World War II. When we left off, he was describing how his destroyer, the USS Ordronox, operating between Maine and Nova Scotia on April 7, 1944, encountered the German submarine U-856.
We located the submarine, and we started depth charging it. And it decided to come up, and they didn't want to give up. So the chaplain said to our captain, or all other captains, "I'm going to ram it." And we had a ramming bow on the front of a destroyer. It's like a knife. And the captain hit that. He didn't hit it dead on. He had a glancing blow. And the submarine cut on that destroyer up at the top. It cut it open, and no sea went into it because it was above the water line and above the oil lines and stuff. But just water went into the cruise cutters. But anyways, they didn't bother. You know, it didn't hurt the ship to going to sink. That captain was the only casualty of that operation. He got hit in the back with shrapnel. They called it friendly fire. See, it was a 20-millimeter shell, and the 20-millimeter guns have stops on them. They won't rotate any further. They go one way, stop. One way, stop. But this one wasn't adjusted right, and the shell ricocheted off of the submarine. Instead of going to the submarine, it went on our ship and ricocheted off of our ship, and the shrapnel went into his back. In the kidneys, I think. They tried to save him. They operated on him. They couldn't save him. They put him in a freezer because we were going to New York, him to his family to bury him. But we couldn't keep him. They said, "We got to get rid of him." So they called us, all our ships, put our dress blues on. We had a funeral for that captain, and we dumped him overseas. But picking this captain up,
you're talking about the German captain now. Yeah. So they initially they weren't going to surrender.
No.
Then you guys rammed them. Well, the chaplain rammed them. Yeah. And then at that point, they decided to surrender?
Well, they were sinking, and it was in the water. And in that water, you only last 15 minutes, and you froze to death. So we picked up the captain, and the executive officer had a 45 pointed at him. Another guy had a submachine gun pointed at him. He gets up on deck. He says, "No need for that today," in good English. So they were interrogating him, and he says, "Where are you taking us?" He says, "Well, we're taking you to Brooklyn Navy Yard, New York City." Oh, he says, "There's no more New York City. Hitler bombed it all out." He said, "Well, we got a surprise for you, but you won't be able to see it because you'll be blindfolded when you leave the ship." So He got off our ship. We don't know where they go. And years later, after the war was over, there was this guy off our ship. I think he was a yeoman. And he was up in B.C., British Columbia, having a vacation there. And he said to the German submarine club was having a reunion there. So he went and asked the German walking around. He says, "You know anything about the U-856? And the guy says, "No, I don't know nothing about it." He says, "But if you go down this hallway and knock on this door, that man's got a book. He'll tell you everything about it." So he went down, knocked on the door, asked the man, "You know about the U-856? He says, "Yeah, I got a book." He got the book out and looked it up. He says, "Yeah, here it is. Here's the captain's name. Here's his address." So he got his address. He wrote him a letter. His captain invited him over to Germany for a vacation. The captain's name was Fritz. In German, that's Frank. So anyways, they're driving down the Autobahn in a Volkswagen. And he says, "Hey, Fritz, you know, he said, I lived through World War II, and I lived through other scrapes. I sure like to go on living." He says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Slow down. 100 miles an hour in a Volkswagen." So anyways, he had his vacation there. He came back to the States, and he gave the executive officer, his name was Owens, Dave Owens. He went over for a week, and then he came back, and he gave the address to another guy, and he went over for a week.
Well, and you're hearing this from your shipmates at these reunions. But did that German captain have anything to say about the time he had spent as a prisoner in the U.S.? Because you guys captured him in April of 44. He was a prisoner here for a while.
Well, yes, we had his address. And our first reunion was in 1991 or 92. I forget which one it was. But it was in Baltimore, Maryland. And we wrote him a letter, asked him, "Come and be our guest." And he said, "Oh, I'd love to go." And we never knew anything about what he was and anything. But he says, "I want to thank you for pulling me out of that sea, because you only last 15 minutes and that was it." And he says, "Another thing, I want to thank you for the best 2 years I had of the war." He says, "I was a prisoner in Phoenix, Arizona. He was a Lutheran, so they gave him a Lutheran layman to take him around town. And he said, that was the best time I had of the war was in there, and I want to thank you for saving my life."
We don't hear those kind of stories too often.
No, you don't.
And that's one of the people that was on that submarine. You said you pulled in 17?
Yes.
Were there some that you guys were not able to save?
Yes, we had one guy come alongside the ship, port side. And we was in a rough sea, not real windy, but rough. They grabbed a hold of him. The ship rolled. They lost the grip on him. He went down under the ship. And on the other side, we done thing to him. We grabbed a hold of him. The ship rolled, and we lost our grip. And he went down under the ship and out the rear end of the ship. And he's waving for us to go get him. But we would not go deficit our ship for one man, because you never know if other submarines are around. Even though we had sound gear, you know, it could come up and shoot and sink us. So we had to watch for our ship and our men.
That must have been hard, though, for a teenager to digest just that reality of that whole situation, the good and the bad.
Well, it was, but I was sure glad I was on the other side.
Yeah. So you had that just off the coast of Portland, Maine there, Casco Bay. And then they sent you back to the Mediterranean after that?
Yeah, we went on a couple more duties, envoy duties. I crossed the Atlantic, I think, about 14 times and had two tours of duty in the Mediterranean. Anyways, when the war was over, we was halfway across the Atlantic and they put us in the Navy Yard and gave us all kinds of things, work I had done to the ship. They put us through the Panama Canal, go to the Pacific. We went to San Diego. San Diego was a little place then. Now it's all grown up. I said to myself, I wouldn't want to go live there. But after I seen them, after I came out to California, it was great. And we went out, went to Pearl Harbor, went swimming in Waikiki. Then we shipped out. We took the battleship Pennsylvania to go to Okinawa.
But before you got to Okinawa, and I'm sorry to interrupt here, but I think people might be interested. This is toward the end of the war, of course, and your ship actually helped recapture one of the first American-held islands to be taken by the Japanese in World War II. We've heard from, on this program, people who were there on Wake Island in December 1941 when the Japanese took them captive. Your ship, the Ordronox, showed up there almost 4 years later in August 1945. And a month later, it was finally back in Allied control. So what do you remember about supporting that recapturing of Wake?
Bombarded the beach, and the battleship Pennsylvania sent out one of their planes to observe, tell us what we're firing on. So it was coming in for landing. Well, how they bring those planes up on there, they put a sled out, and they let that sled float, and they're pulling it on the back of the ship. And then the plane taxis up on it with its pontoon. They secure it, but this plane came up and it tipped over. They lost the plane. So they gave us orders to sink it. So we went up and picked up this pilot. He was sitting on the pontoon. We went up and picked him up. Then we fired a 5-inch 38 and sunk the plane. Because they won't reuse the plane over again, not once it's in the salt water. And then we went out to Okinawa. While we was in the Pacific, we rode two typhoons out. We would go out and patrol near the island where Ernie Pyle was killed. Then this typhoon came up, and all the ships had to get out, get underway. So there was a cruiser. It was towing a metal sub chaser. Anyways, they had a big rope on that. It stayed there and went with them. But ahead of us, there was a aircraft carrier. It was about 5 miles ahead of us, and we couldn't see it. But anyways, they passed the word out, man overboard. And they're not going to put a boat out to go get my man. But luck was having it, and I believe God was with that man. He came right alongside our ship. We got a boat hook, grabbed a hold of him with a boat hook, pulled him on board. Great deal. And then we was in another typhoon. We was in Japan. Japan had already surrendered. We was anchored in this river, like, with our bow facing waves and weather. And we had the anchor down, and we was turning over 5 knots just to keep the ship in line, keep it one place, you know. That was another typhoon we went through. So anyways, when after that, we went to Tokyo Bay. And we got in Tokyo Bay on Friday. And Saturday was when they were going to surrender on the Missouri. They said to us, get out and go on patrol. So we had to go out and go on patrol. What for? You know, ships, well, get them. We had Japanese submarines coming in and that. They didn't want to fight. They were all done. Yeah. But we got on the way. Then we came back after that into Tokyo Bay, and it was raining cats and dogs. And I said, only 3 hours. I'm not going to put my blues on and go out there for 3 hours and come back get all wet. So I didn't go. I missed that time. Then after that, we all got ready to go back to Hawaii, and we stayed there. Then they, you know, you're going to the States when they put the commission pendant up, and all the flags, get underway. And on the way back, we went to San Diego, and then we got underway, going through the Panama Canal, and we went into the Mexican seas. It was nice and sunny, and there was all big sea turtles floating there. So the captain says, let's put the boat out and go get some turtle. We'll have turtle soup. So they put a boat out and went and got some turtles, and cooks made turtle soup. I tasted it. I said, oh, wow, it tastes like salt water. I said, forget it. And then we went to the shipyard in South Carolina. We had to do all the work. We had to put it out of commission. And there was guys getting out in the Navy and that. I couldn't get out. My time wasn't up. My enlistment was up, but my time wasn't up. I didn't have enough points. You got to buy points. If you was married, you have more points. If you had kids, there's more points. If you're like me, I didn't have no points. So I had to stay. And they put me on another ship, the Arcadia. It was a destroyer ship, take care of destroyers out in the Pacific and places. But anyways, I went home on the train and went up to Boston, got out. I live about 51 miles from Boston. If you want, I'll show you my medals.
I've got a few questions, too, while we're on the topic of getting back home to Boston. Here, your mom had signed for you when you were 17 to go into the Navy. What was it like to come back home after the war's all over and see her again when she knows that you made it through?
Well, she was happy, and she was a great lady. I miss her. I love her.
You think she did a little praying for you while you were over there?
Yes, she had. So somebody was praying for me. Because I had a lot of things happen to me where I almost died. I could have been killed.
Well, it's break time again, but let's make sure to hear about some of those when we come back. Frank Ormerod, 93-year-old Navy veteran of World War II, is our guest today. You will find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we're going to hear some more of those close calls from during and even before his Navy days, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 93-year-old Frank Ormerod of Auburn, California, originally from Fall River, Massachusetts. He was a tin can sailor in World War II, serving on the destroyer USS Ordronox. We've heard about some of his close calls, including when his destroyer helped capture a German submarine just off of Maine in 1944. But Frank told me he can think of at least five times in his life when he believes God spared his life, even going back to his childhood. So let's hear about it, Frank. What were some more of those situations? And maybe help us understand why you feel so strongly that there was divine intervention involved.
Well, I can go way back. I know the Lord saved my life when I was about 12 years old. I was a dyslexic. I didn't have any schooling, and it's been really hard on my life because I can't spell, I can't figure. Everything's been hard for me, but I know the Lord was with me because I was in the fifth grade, and they moved me up to the eighth grade, and I couldn't do the work. But I had a good friend. He could figure it out, and he could do this, and he'd give me all this stuff, and I would copy it. When I got in the Navy, I put down the eighth grade, but I didn't have any education. I couldn't do anything, no? But I was a mechanical-minded. We was operating with a carrier. We was taking it to the Mediterranean, and it was our squadron. There was four destroyers, two on the side, starboard and port side, and one in the back. And we were 5 miles ahead, screening for submarines with sound gear. You know, I was gonna go on my watch down in the engine room, and it was pretty rough because they didn't want us to use the main deck. They told us to use the catwalk. I climbed up the ladder, and the ship rolled, and I tried to feel for the bars, but the ship was rolling, it was gone of there, and I fell backwards 9 foot. I was going over the side, and a little cable stopped me. I know God's side. Another time, we was in Oran, climbing this mountain, and I fell, and I couldn't stop rolling. A tree stopped me, and I lost my ID card, and I didn't know it. And I went back to the ship, and if you lose your ID card, you can't get off the ship. Anyways, the next morning, I asked the executive officer if I could go find my ID card. I think I know where I lost it. Sure enough, where I hit that tree was my ID card. Now, how it got out of my pocket, only the Lord knows. And I know he saved my life. Because after that tree, I would have fell 500 feet down. They were excavating the mountain, using the dirt for gravel and stuff. So I knew the Lord saved my life. Well, when I was 12 years old, there was five boys and four bicycles. And I had a skinny tire bike. And the other guys all had balloon tire bikes. And my bike wouldn't hold two people. So I let this guy, he had a Silver King, which was made out of aluminum, and the fork broke on him. So he didn't know how to have it welded or nothing. So anyways, I let him ride my bike, and I rode with this other guy. He was a big, heavy guy. Anyways, he was powerful, and that he could take care of two guys. We were on a country road, and the country road went down a hill, and at the bottom of the hill was a red light, and main highway, Highway 6, I think it was, ran, and you had to stop because of traffic. But the red light was out, so they had no red light. And the Holy Spirit said to me, "Get off this bike." And I obeyed him. I told Albert, I said, "I want to get off." He said, "Oh, no, no, stay with me for a while." I said, "No, no, I want to get off the bike." I didn't tell him anything that the Holy Spirit told me. And anyways, he didn't want to let me off the bike. So I told him, "If you don't let me off, I'm going to stick my feet in the spokes." He said, "Okay, okay, I'll let you off." He let me off. And Jimmy McGay, he was the guy. His bike had broken down. He was riding my bike, so couldn't ride two guys on my bike because of the tires. So he had to go with Albert. Albert wanted him to come with him, but Jimmy looked at me, and he said he didn't want to get on that bike. But anyways, he says, "I'll go." So he got on the bike. They went down the hill. They hit a car in the rear, and Albert was thrown up over the side of the road, and Albert was a big guy. He just went up in the air and then came down. And I went over and I talked to Albert. I called him, "Come on, come on, you're all right, get up, get up." But he didn't move. And I went over to Jimmy, and I said, same thing. I told him, "Come on, Jimmy, get up, get up." No, he couldn't get up. So they took him and they put him in a car. They didn't wait for an ambulance. And on the way there, Jimmy died, and Albert died 5 o'clock in the morning. And anyways, tough job losing friends like that. But I know the Lord saved my life that night.
Well, and I guess the question is, if you feel that he saved your life then and multiple times during World War II in the Navy, what was he saving you for? Did that change the way you approached things because you felt your life had been spared?
No, I didn't. It wasn't till later on in life I realized these things. Then I became a Christian and followed Christ Jesus. He's my Savior, and I love him to death. He says in Revelation 2:10, "Be ye faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life."
You know, I realized something I didn't ask you about that often gets lost because we hear so much about the Normandy invasion. People forget about all the other invasions in Europe, whether they be in Italy or the invasion of southern France.
Yes.
And I think you guys supported that, didn't you?
Yes, we supported southern France invasion. We were bombarding the beach, and they were told to stay out 2,000 yards, and the captain disobeyed that. He went in 1,000 yards. After the war, they prosecuted him for it. Anyways, I enjoyed the Navy.
What would you say was the hardest thing for you to deal with in World War II?
Well, like I told you about that shell, I picked it up. That was really hard, because I shook like mad after I threw it overboard.
Have you been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I have.
Well, what did you think of when you were there, when you're looking at that whole memorial, the gold stars signifying all those who died and the names of the states, the different theaters, the battles? What was meaningful to you to be there?
Well, I thank God that I never got wounded. I thank God for the life I have in the great country I live in. God made this country for us, for people who would love it and live in it and do it right.
And risk their lives for it, which you did, and which 16 million Americans did in World War II. Is there something that you think we need to understand or realize or remember today about what all of you did so long ago?
Well, today is a different story with this atomic age. And we have a government that's at war today, the Democrats and the Republicans. When I first got out of the Navy, that I fell, I hurt my back, and I used to lay on the floor. My kids would see me, hurt like mad. I went to the government, asked them, could they help me? And they said, no, no, no. But now I go to the government, I have diabetes, and they give me insulin and needles and stuff for my diabetes. And you know what it cost me? Cost me $8
a month.
And I'm thankful for that. Used to cost me over $100-some.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. Is there anything we didn't touch on that you think is important for people to know about your time in the Navy or what you're proud of?
Well, I'm proud of being in the Navy. My brother wanted me to go in the Army. I said, no, I want to go in the Navy. I don't want to be a ground pounder, although I would have probably been better in the Army because I'm a mechanic. You know, Navy didn't have a lot of mechanics. But I went in the Navy. And I'll tell you a time when we have boats to take the crew out and the captain on liberty and stuff. And when we're in port, anyways, we had this one boat. They took off our other boat to balance the ship. See, whenever they put guns on, they had to balance the ship. So they took one boat off, and they had the captain's boat. And this kid, I knew him. I went to boot camp with him, and his name was Richard Peachy. We was on the way, and I seen the boat, and he was working on it. So I climbed up there, and I told him, hey, Peachy, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm pulling the engine down. It's froze up. I said, yeah? Tell me what happened. He said, well, we pulled up alongside this ship and let the captain off. He said, I went back aft and tied up and tried to start the engine. It was froze. I said, don't tear it apart. The only thing you want to do is take the bolts from the starter, loosen them up, jiggle it, and it'll start. It'll go away. Oh, he said, oh, no, okay. The lieutenant told me to take it apart. I said, well, okay. So I went to that lieutenant, and I told him, I said, sir, the engine's not frozen up. I said, the only thing's wrong with it is that the starter's locked up on the ring gear. I said, if you loosen up the starter, it'll turn over. He says, you mind your own business. I told him to tear it apart. Okay, but see, I'm just a fireman. I couldn't go up and talk to the captain. Oh, no, he probably threw me in the brig, but the captain was so mad at this lieutenant, we used to call him 90-Day Wonders. Now, I'll tell you a story about the 90-Day Wonder. The captain had some gear he wanted stored, and he gave it to this lieutenant. And he says, store this gear for me. He says, okay. So he gave it to a seaman. Well, he was a third class. We'll store the gear for the captain. So the captain says, where's my gear? I need it now. He said, well, I'll go ask him. So he went and asked the man that stored it. He says, where did you store that gear? He said, oh, I put it in locker 13. Oh, okay. So he went and told the captain, oh, the gear's in locker 13. The captain said, you fool, he threw it overside.
Didn't know what locker 13 was, huh?
No.
When you got out of the Navy, you were a mechanic after the war?
Oh, yes. I went back to work for Pontiac, but original owner, and he sold to another man. I went to him, and I told him, I'd like my job back. He says, no, if you go on the GI Bill, I'll give you a job back. So I said, sure, what do I care, you know? As long as I get money and paid. When it come to me getting off the GI Bill, they're supposed to bring me up to the money the other mechanics were making. But he wouldn't do it. He said, no, no. So it was this guy I used to work with. His name was Kay Elias. He says, I'm going to go to work for Dodge. So I asked him, I said, you think there's any openings up there? He said, why don't you come up and talk to him? So I went up and talked to him. He says, sure, I'll take you in as an accessory man. Accessory man is putting in heaters and radios and stuff like that, you know. He never had me do that. He was always having me work on everything as a mechanic. But he told me, he'd give me $1.10 an hour. So I stayed with him until I got married. I got married when I was working for Pontiac. And I told my wife when I got married, I says, I'll get married to you. And we'll have four kids. I don't know why I said that, but she says, I want four kids, because I guess there's four kids in my family, you know. She said, all right. I said, we're going to California. 6 months after I'm married. She says, okay. I have my aunt living out here in Alameda. So my sister had a 39 Chevrolet, and I had a 35 Plymouth. I said to my sister, I'll trade your cars. My car's in better shape than yours. So she said, yeah. So I gave her my car, and she gave me hers. I overhauled it and put a clutch in it and new tires and brakes, painted it, and I drove it out to California.
Let me ask you this, one last thing. You think about your grandkids and people that age, again, people who didn't live through World War II. What do we need to know about it? Why is it important that we remember World War II and guys like you who fought over there? What do you think would be different about the world today if you and all the Allies didn't win?
Well, we'd either be speaking German or Japanese. I think mostly German.
Well, and surely there would be a few other differences too. Every single veteran we have the privilege of meeting here on Hometown Heroes has a truly unique story, a truly unique journey through life. And Frank Ormerod has been no exception today. Don't forget to head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Frank then and now, as well as more information about his destroyer, the USS Ordronox. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.